Now that we have returned from the break, we are going to do a little comparative work on 1 Chronicles 17 and 2 Samuel 7, the two renditions of the Davidic promise, or the dynastic promise, as it is sometimes called. And so I want to write some things on the board, even as you tell me some of the things you've noticed in comparing these. Remember, last time I gave you a handout from James Newsom's, I think it's James Newsom's book. Yes, James Newsom's book, A Synoptic Harmony of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, using the RSV text, but laid out in such a way that you can more easily spot the differences between the texts, the similarities and differences. For those of you who go on and learn Hebrew, there's a nice little Hebrew rendition of this with some of the differences in red. The text is mainly in black, but the differences are in red. And of course, gaps are left where material is in one text but not in the other. So, in terms of differences that you think might or might not be significant, obviously I'm aiming more for those that might be significant, I'll write some of these on the board if you will just tell me what differences you noticed. Who wants to start us off in doing this synoptic comparison? Yes. Okay, so 2 Samuel, how did you describe it? 2 Samuel was more formal and legal, using the terminology king, whereas Chronicles was more informal or personal, using David. And 2 Samuel 7 also used Lord or Yahweh more often, and Chronicles used God. Okay. Now, you actually get a kind of a switching back and forth in both of these texts, which is a bit curious in its own way. All right, what other differences did you notice? Yes. Okay, so the difference in pronouns there, your kingdom, my kingdom, might well be significant. What else? Okay, can you specify, the comment is that 1 Chronicles seems to be more encouraging, leaving out some of the negative aspects of the 2 Samuel text. What can you specify one of those negative, or one or more of those negative aspects? Okay, that is 2 Samuel 7:13, or what is it? 14? Okay, verse 14. Okay, so that whole statement there is actually left out of 1 Chronicles 17. All right, except perhaps an oblique reference, is it? I mean, what is said of Saul in the 2 Samuel 7 passage? Okay, it mentions Saul explicitly, does it not? I don't have the text right here before me.
Oh dear, okay.
Do you still hear any sound here? In the 2 Samuel text, let's see, where is this? Verse 15, "But my love will never be taken away from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you." And here it just says, "I will never." In First Chronicles, it says, "I will never take my love away from him as I took it away from your predecessor." Okay, so it does mention obliquely Saul, but rather than using the name Saul explicitly, it just says your predecessor, sort of more generalizing in a sense. Other differences, more minor differences? Yes. Okay, the Ark of the Covenant, little abbreviation of the Lord, as compared to the Ark of God. So, again, maybe emphasis on covenant there might be significant. What else, Dave? Okay, yeah. Now, Samuel talks about the tribes of Israel, whereas Chronicles talks about the judges of Israel. Now, that's a tricky one, because that is really just a text-critical question. The word judges or leaders of Israel would be shofet or shoftei, and tribes is shivtei. So it's a difference of one letter. And the likelihood is that there's no significance to that difference, other than the reading judges is probably the correct reading, rather than tribes. Okay, yeah, William? Okay, the words used in Chronicles are more dramatic? Right, okay. All right. Yeah, I don't know how to sum. Speaking of the, go ahead and say it again. Okay, so the Chronicles references to the what men will do, wasting them, seems to be more dramatic than afflicting them. All right, I don't know quite how to summarize that on the board, but we'll take that under advisement as well. You had a comment. Okay, yeah, the difference between Samuel does speak more about rest, and Chronicles more about subduing enemies. All right, we're going to talk about the significance of these in just a minute. We're more just kind of noting them at the moment. Yes, Jennifer. Yeah, in the early verse there, just leaves out the reference to the Lord giving David or giving the king rest from all his enemies round about. That's not included in the chronicler's text. Any others? Other things that, I mean, there are other minor details. What about no mention of the floggings. I think we got this one in terms of the chastening with the rod of men. William? Okay. What verse were you in Samuel?
Samuel, verse 9.
Oh, verse 9, right, okay. Yeah. Right, okay, so interesting idea. In the Chronicles passage, by leaving out the word great after name or before name in the English, and I make you your name great or give you a great name, leaving that out may put the emphasis more on the one who is giving the blessing rather than the one who is receiving the blessing and thus becoming great. Although in Chronicles it does say, like the names of the greatest men of all the earth. So there is still this notion of greatness in there somewhere. What about verse 6? In the NIV it says, I have not dwelt in a house from the day I brought the Israelites up out of Egypt to this day. In Chronicles it says, I have not dwelt in a house from the day I brought Israel up to this day. Okay, so the Samuel text has this phrase, out of Egypt, and the chronicler's text does not have that particular phrase, but does speak of bringing Israel up. There's another difference, I think, in that verse. I have been moving from place to place with a tent for my dwelling. And in the Chronicles passage, it says, I have moved from one tent site to another, from one dwelling place to another. The slight difference there as well. The Samuel text maybe being more suggestive of the tabernacle as a place in which God dwells, whereas the chronicler is really saying from tent to tent, from place to place. Okay? Yes, Jennifer. In 2 Samuel, where? 21? Hang on just a minute. I wasn't aware that we had gone... I'm not sure we wanted to go that far. Yeah, I know. I'm in the right chapter, but hang on just a minute. Yeah, I really was thinking we should probably stop at 17, because if we go on beyond that, we'll get into more and more and more interesting things. I told you once I read through this particular book, and it's a great exercise if you want to do it. Read through this and look at them in parallel and buy your own copy and make a lot of marginal notes. This is the library copy. My copy's at home. But it is a very interesting exercise to do that. And what we're doing now on a micro scale, you do that on a macro scale, you really get an impression of what is allowable in Scripture. What are the working habits of biblical historians? Now, what we learn from this, just as a start, is that we need to be very careful with looking at English texts which have direct quotation marks and assuming that what we're getting is tape recordings, you know, or verbatim transcripts. Because if you compare these two texts, we discover that they're not exactly alike as one might expect if they were both direct quotations, such as, according to the standards that we employ today. Now, it's good for us to know that. It doesn't undermine the veracity of the text. It just helps us to understand it on its own terms, as God intended it. But what can we make more specifically? What kinds of inferences can we draw about the different purposes of the Samuel material vis-a-vis the Chronicles material? Perhaps thinking about the audiences that they were addressing and the questions that they were asking, what can we make from even these kinds of differences? Maybe not. We may not be able to make something of all of them. There are various different reasons that Chronicles and Samuel Kings differ from time to time. Sometimes it's a text-critical question, as we saw with the tribes and judges. You know, Shiftei, Shoftei, very much alike in Hebrew. There, sometimes it may have been that the chronicler was drawing on a forlaga, or a primary text that differed slightly from the Samuel or Kings material as we now have it. Okay, so it may be something as simple as that. Sometimes it may be that the chronicler is simply summarizing or generalizing what he is reading. But sometimes I think the chronicler intentionally brings in some small alterations for a purpose. Now, again, I'm not saying he's distorting the facts, and we'll talk about exactly what he is doing in just a minute. But what would you make of some of these? What about that first one? A shift from speaking of David in terms of king and speaking of David as David. What might that accomplish? Yes? Okay. Okay, it might help the people focus on the kind of king that God's going to accept, being a Davidic kind of king. All right? Yes? Okay, it might help them to take a more personal view, is the comment, on what God is doing with David. Now, think in terms of, think in terms of the audience that the chronicler is addressing as opposed to David. Bishop? Okay. Yeah, a possibility that by expressly naming David, it clarifies what king is in view. I think probably, I mean, if we looked at the chronicler's text, I think that's probably contextually clear already in the broader context, because this is the story as it was known. So that probably would have been clear. Yes. Okay, is it to clarify that the covenant was made with David as a person rather than with the king as a position, is the comment. Yeah, I think so. I think that could be what's going on here, because think about it, the addressees of the chronicler are coming back out of exile. There is no king on the throne. There is no throne. The kingdom has fallen. Now people are returning to try to rebuild the temple, but they're not rebuilding the throne. There's not a king. There's not a visible human king in sight. And so the question is pressing: if God promised something to Davidic kings, are those promises still in force? And if so, in what sense? Well, the answer is God made a promise to David, to a person. Now, his descendants are still amongst us. It wasn't so much that God made a promise to a king as that he made it to David, a person. So the chronicler wants to stress that this promise was a personal promise from God to David and his children after him. And those children are still amongst us. And so the promise is still in force. We don't need a throne. We don't need a human throne for these promises to continue in force. That's one possibility. You know, I think that makes sense. What of some of these others? What about this one? Your kingdom, my kingdom. In, let's see, in 2 Samuel chapter 7, let's see where it is, 16, all the way down there. Okay. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. Those are the words spoken by God to David, as recorded in 2 Samuel 7. And if someone had to say, well, which is closer to the tape recording, I would probably choose 2 Samuel 7 as being closer to the tape recording, closer to the actual words spoken. But the chronicler, rather than that, says in 1 Chronicles 17:14, I will set him over my house and my kingdom forever. His throne will be established forever. What do we make of that? Yes. Okay, yeah, the comment relates to the fact that when David was chosen, he seemed to be God's choice as opposed to the people's choice. There is a real sense in which God identifies himself with David, and David is his king. And in fact, he talks about, I will be his father and he will be my son. It's implicit in those words is the fact that the throne of David being established is in a very real sense God's throne. And so if we look at the implications of that, we recognize that the Davidic kings in a very real sense occupy God's throne on earth. Now, they're not gods themselves. They are his representatives. You know, they are his human vassals. But by his choice, they occupy his thrones. His throne. Look at 1 Chronicles 28:5. Now, this is describing David's preparations for and plans for a temple, which is described much more fully in Chronicles than it ever was in Samuel. And in verse 5, it says, "Of all my sons, and the Lord has given me many, he has chosen my son Solomon to sit on the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel." So, see, even David understood that his kingdom was really God's kingdom, visibly being manifest on earth. This was a theocracy. Now, the reason it's important then for those returning from exile to realize that the Davidic kingdom is not so much the thing as God's kingdom is that the Davidic king is not on the throne, but God's kingdom remains nevertheless. And so by this subtle change, he takes what is implicit in the promise and makes it explicit in his particular representation of the promise, or in his rendition of the promise. Let's see what else might be significant. This verse 14 of 2 Samuel 7, chastened with the rod of men, or with the floggings inflicted by men. Those who had gone into exile were well aware of that. They didn't need to hear that yet again. They knew that happened because it had happened to them. Now they're coming back. They don't need that discouraging word again. They've experienced that. And so the chronicler says, you don't need to hear that again. You know it. You know it's there in the words that you and I know so well. I don't want to major on that. I'm not even going to mention that as I recall this incident for you. I want to be a little more encouraging than that. Likewise, rather than being very specific in talking about Saul, the chronicler is interested in a way in expanding the promise and generalizing it and using more general terminology like your predecessor, or this business about out of Egypt, where he says in verse 6 in Samuel 2 Samuel 7, "I have not dwelt in a house from the day I brought the Israelites up out of Egypt to this day." Well, by leaving out of Egypt in the text, he would have made it very specific and made the focus entirely on the deliverance out of Egypt, out of the bondage there. By leaving that out, he's saying, you know, you could apply this promise really now to the deliverance we're experiencing coming out of another land of bondage. You see, so the chronicler is painting the picture with some different brush strokes, including detail, you know, leaving out a few details that are not as pertinent for the picture he's trying to paint for his particular audience to get across the message that they need to hear. Likewise with the Ark of God, the Ark of the Covenant of God. By stressing the covenant, again, he's saying, yeah, the covenants are still in force for us. And we could go on about this. In fact, if you hadn't noticed, I did go on about this in the Art of Biblical History in chapter 2 at the end. So you can go there and read more about that. I didn't want to tell you that right off because I wanted you to go and do your own inspection of these texts and find these things again. But there's a nice little parallel chart there that you can find that will help you with this if that's of any advantage. But I think by looking at this kind of thing, it does alert us to the way in which historiographers work. Now, let me see what else we may need to say about this. As we think generally about the book of Chronicles, in comparison to Samuel and Kings, we notice some other things. If you were to look at an overarching structure of the two, we would discover that there is an idealization of David and his line, There's nothing said about the power struggle and the death with Saul and the power struggle that went on with the house of Saul after his death. There's nothing said of the murders of Abner and Ishbosheth, nothing of David's problems with Michal, Saul's daughter, his wife, or of his sin with Bathsheba. None of these things are mentioned, nor are the darker sides of Solomon mentioned. What is the significance of this? I don't think the chronicler is at all attempting to rewrite history. Remember, he's not trying to overpaint the earlier painting. He is painting another picture of the past to highlight certain elements that are important to his given audience. Leaving out some of these darker tones does not mean at all that he's trying to distort the picture of the past. He's looking at the past from a different light. And that's very important for us, I think, to understand. The shift of focus from David's kingdom to my kingdom, that is the Lord speaking, the shift from David's kingdom to Yahweh's kingdom, I think encourages then the messianic hope which comes more and more to characterize this time period. The idealization of David and the stress on the kingdom of Yahweh, I think, bolstered hope in a Davidic Messiah who was to come. And these idealized kings like David or Solomon or Asa or Jehoshaphat or Hezekiah or Josiah, all of whom are perhaps a little more, I hate to use even the word accurately, but in Kings we get a more well-rounded picture of their pros and cons, their good sides and their bad sides, their virtues and their flaws. In Chronicles, they're idealized, and by virtue of this, then the messianic hope is bolstered as we see them indwelling the throne of Yahweh, and we have hope that as they were victorious over God's enemies and promoted covenant faithfulness, so they serve as types of a greater son of David who would come and do even better than they, who would fulfill these hopes of victory and of covenant faithfulness in a way that even they fell short of. Okay, so I hope, you know, we could go on and on about the different aspects of the chronicler's method here, but I guess the main point I'm trying to get across is, let's not just say to ourselves, I think this is the way the Bible should have written its histories. We need to look at it and see how it actually wrote its histories, and then say, what do we make of that? How do we understand it? How do we account for the differences when we know that both of these texts are divinely inspired? God knew what He was doing. These are the paintings, these are the pictures of the past that He wants us to see and embrace. What do we make of the differences? You know, some critical scholars would say, well, you know, they're simply contradictory and you can't have them both. Well, I think that is as simplistic as looking at two portraits of an individual and saying they don't exactly match, therefore they're one of them or both of them have to be inaccurate. I think what we have in the chronicler is an attempt to draw out of the text that which is actually there, but there implicitly, and make it explicit, and actually present it as God saying, my kingdom, rather than your kingdom. Any more that needs to be said on that? Any comments or questions on that? I'm going to kind of stop there because I do want to have time to do other things tonight. So we're going to take a funny break here in a little while, but not yet. Yes, William. Yeah, although I think that concept was birthed really with 2 Samuel 7 already, you know, and those exceptional promises which David himself seemed to recognize were exceptional. I'm sorry, I didn't repeat the question. Would the people have thought of the phrase Son of David as messianic prior to the time of Chronicles? It's hard to pin it down exactly, but I think so. I think it was something that was gradually growing in their consciousness. I don't think the people of Israel knew with certainty what shape the promises to David would take. And probably most of them imagined a visible king sitting on a visible throne. But there was something that about the promise that was so magnificent that it exploded those normal categories. And in time, I think it became clear that God had something larger in view than just that. Okay, any other comments or questions? Let me take this opportunity. We're not going to take a break just yet, and I don't know in terms of taping whether we want to get this or not. We may, because I want to take a little time now to talk about the exam. While people have not completely crumbled in these late night sessions, to talk a little bit about exam and to ask questions. It may be good to go ahead and tape this, in as much as people who view these tapes someday will be taking an exam, if not exactly the same exam, that I'm going to talk about now. So, let me make a few general comments, and then I'll let you ask some questions, hopefully not too specific questions, like, could you give me the answer to question number 5, or whatever. The exam is going to be objective in nature. It is going to deal very largely with Bible content. That is to say, don't ignore everything else, but Bible content is very important. It will pick up where we left off in terms of the midterm, which means we pick up really, yeah, okay, I was trying to recall myself. 2 Samuel, you can tell I'm not quite finished with this exam yet. At the beginning of 2 Samuel? Okay. Right. Yeah, the question is, since I didn't ask a lot on 1 Samuel or anything on 1 Samuel on that test, and people are stabbing her in the back, am I going to pick up there? I'm trying to recall questions I've already composed. I hate to make general statements. Let's say have a nodding acquaintance. You should have a nodding acquaintance of what happens in 1 Samuel anyway. Yes. Well, I think she's probably referring to after Saul. Is that right? Yeah, because there were some other questions on 1 Samuel, certainly in the first 7 chapters and such. No, I don't think I did, because I can't honestly, I'm trying to think through questions I have already composed. I would hate to say nothing on 1 Samuel. Yeah, I wish you weren't taking this. For the midterm, had we finished 1 Samuel before the midterm? We didn't talk about Saul at all after that? Okay, crumbs. Okay, there will be nothing on Saul on this final, and yeah, I will go ahead and say nothing on 1 Samuel. We'll pick up 2 Samuel and forward. Now, was that clear enough for you? Not 2 Samuel and forward. Okay, all the way through Revelation. No, just kidding. All right. Now there will be there. You'll want to know the kings of Israel and Judah. Okay, as you know, we've drilled that from time to time. You'll want to know that. You'll want to know significant dates. Let's see. In terms of secondary reading, such as you've done in Howard, you want to have a knowledge of the big things. For instance, in his discussion of Ezra and Nehemiah, and we are going to come to Ezra and Nehemiah after a break in just a second, but only briefly. In his discussion of Ezra and Nehemiah, he does draw some conclusions on debated points in terms of, what was the order of arrival of Ezra and Nehemiah? Was it Nehemiah-Ezra? Was it Ezra and Nehemiah together? You know, exactly what does Howard think? So when he comes to the bottom line of those discussions, you should know where he stands on some of those things. I wish I had my questions before me. I could be more helpful. Maybe I will be a little more helpful next time when you come early. Yeah. You will have already studied, but, you know, the icing on the cake could be helpful. Yes, question, Sandra. Oh, yeah, I'm talking about the actual dates that are in bold. Again, I don't have my... I should be looking at a sheet. Really, the dates that are on the left-hand column, those are the ones I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the years of the king's reign. Now, if anyone wants extra credit by learning all of those, we'll consider it, but I wouldn't suggest that would be the profitable use of your time.
Yeah.
So, largely objective, kings of Israel and Judah, important. Secondary reading, be sure to know the main things. There are a few questions about the art of biblical history, questions you've seen before. A word to the wise. questions you've seen before. You can go visit the secretary and have a look at them, which is a good idea, and part of the reason I do that is so that you can go and see, oh, I missed that. Might want to go over it and see what you did or didn't miss. Okay. Her hours are really 7:30 to 4 or 4:30, Monday to Friday. Is that impossible? That's true. It's hard for the evening classes. Can you put a call in from work? Yeah. Boy, there are all kinds of complications dealing with an evening class, aren't there? Yeah, there are all kinds of complications. There are only a few, by the way, of these questions. Yes? No. Thanks. Can you fax the quiz? Can they fax the quiz to them? Yeah. I really don't know how to handle this one if you're locked in and can't possibly ever get by when the secretary's around. Yeah, take questions off the exam. Uh-huh. Anyone have a better suggestion? No, seriously, there are only a few. I would say if you can't get by to look at your test, the best thing really you can do is to look back at your whatever few notes you may have taken on the book, about the book. I'm sorry, but I don't think it'll make a massive difference to you in a big way, but there are a few. Yes?
Would you like us to know which chapter?
It's more important that you know what, the order and the centuries. The question is, should you know what chapters the Kings occur in? Now, you should have, in terms of your knowledge of Kings, the books of Kings, you do want to have a major block understanding of what happens where. But when the Kings of Israel and Judah are toggling back and forth in very confusing fashion, that's going to be more difficult. But you should know where Ahab, for instance, comes and his relationship with Elijah and Elisha and kind of the sequence that goes on there. And the way in which I'll ask questions there, if you have a pretty straightforward knowledge of the larger flow of the narrative, you should be able, by a process of elimination, to figure out what goes with what. Okay? Other questions? That means you don't have to have an exact knowledge that this king and this event occur exactly in this chapter, as long as you know within a few chapters where it occurs, because I'm not going to have things bang, bang, bang right together so that intending to confuse you. All right? There is a matching format in there. And also, I should mention that the material we're going to cover after this break dealing with Ezra and Nehemiah is on the exam and is reasonably important. It'll be reasonably fresh, so you want to give some attention to Ezra and Nehemiah, too, in terms of having a basic outline in mind for those. And I hope you are turning in Ezra and Nehemiah outlines tonight. Yes? Yes, there was one significant typo. Yes. Yes, I have, but that's not any security. I will try to get someone else to proofread it too, to make sure. Yes, any other questions, comments, caveats? Yes. Would you like an essay at this stage? At this stage I have in mind purely objective, so we can have a quick turnaround on grading, which is something they press us to. They throw us into interterm, and yet they want our grades right away. And it's going to be tough because I've got all kinds of exegesis papers to grade and some papers in this class, too. So as things now stand, there is not an essay component to the test. Volunteers to proofread. Yes, oh, by all means. Good suggestion. Yes. Right, and that question was rectified, though. I don't know if you've seen your more recent grades, but though we did go back and deal with that because that question did arise. Yes, that question did arise, and so grades were actually adjusted to make that better. Okay. So obviously, I mean, I'll be working off my own understanding of the content of the books. So what I put down as an outline, you might think, well, that's kind of the way he sees it. But I'm not gonna. I will not have something exactly like that last one. Okay. Did you have another? Was that it? I don't think there's any going to be any fill in the blank. You know, so it's all just, you know, Russian roulette. Look, we better not. We'll stop with this one. We'll stop with this one. Or that one, these two, because we do need to get some Ezra and Nehemiah under our belt before we can quit tonight. So, yes, Jennifer first. Will there be anything from Matthew's and Benjamin book? Have you read it? Yes. No. Yes. I just want to make sure you'd read it, because that's the profit of doing it. Yes. Yes, the answer was no. Mm-hmm. How in depth will I go with Chronicles? Only the kinds of things we've talked about here. Okay, so I don't expect you to have read Chronicles. All right, such an enlightening time. Did I say that was the last one? One more. Oh, this is important. Yes, good question. Thank you for asking it. We were talking about it during the break. The infamous reading report, which you've never seen, you know, be sure to fill it out according to the form, which you never received. That had completely escaped my memory that you had never received that. What I will do is next time, when you take the exam, there will be on the exam a place to record percentages. So come prepared to say, I have completed such and such percentage of the secondary reading or the Bible reading. Give me an honest answer. You will be signing your name to that. So come prepared to give me that, and that will suffice in this instance as your reading report. Save yourself the trouble of recording every jot and tittle. Okay? Can we stop and take a break? All right, we'll take a break. I'll talk to you during the break. We'll take a break and come back and talk about Ezra and Nehemiah before our time is completely gone.